I'm Alex, your host for this episode of MIR Meets. Today we are joined by Kyle Matthews, the Executive Director of the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies. He is also the founder and director of the Digital Mass Atrocity Prevention Lab, a policy hub working to combat online extremism. This episode focuses on the spread of digital extremism, specifically in relation to privacy concerns, challenges in mitigation, and the advent of artificial intelligence as a new threat. Hi, Kyle. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure to join you.
Yeah, and it's great to have you here as well. So our first main debate asks the question, at what point do we sacrifice individual privacy for collective safety? So an argument for sacrificing privacy for safety could be seen in situations where malicious intent is clearly expressed online. So I'd like to bring up the example of American mass shootings where an incriminating online presence is commonly seen before an attack, specifically through engagement with extremist echo chambers. I'll give an example of a 2022 supermarket shooting in Buffalo, where the perpetrator had extensive chat logs asking about the efficacy of body armor, stating his planned attack date and location, and expressing his white supremacist motives for violence. So in regard to atrocity prevention, heavy monitoring of these activities could lead to a decrease in incidents of mass shootings. However, this type of digital surveillance can also be seen as an infringement of personal privacy. So what I'd like to hear your take on is, considering the monitoring of immediate domestic threats to security, how can you approach the delicate equilibrium between protecting individual freedoms, but also implementing measures to counteract extremist activities?
So the first thing I think one has to point out is that when people make statements online on public platforms, that's for everyone to see. So the issue of privacy doesn't necessarily come into play when you're openly using Twitter, Facebook, or other platforms to incite violence towards certain groups based on their identity, or if you're calling for violence or trying to dehumanize that group. So privacy doesn't really fit into that picture. Privacy does come into the picture, however, if a state is trying to access your private communications. So that's why we have robust laws that says that be it police, other intelligence agencies or others must get a permit and they must have a well-founded fear that someone is doing something in order to be able to listen in to them or try to crack their code. So there is already this issue of privacy that's based on Canadian law, and it's also on international law as well. So one has to be very, very careful. There has to be, some evidence or some information made available to the police force or security agencies that think a certain individual might be an extremist and engaging in nefarious behavior or planning an attack or violence or what. So I would just put that out there but publish openly calling for things on Facebook platform. That's not, if someone comes across that, reports you to the police, that's not a privacy issue. That's you've expressed something publicly. It becomes much more complicated though, if one is trying to access, and you see this in those trying to counter extremism online, is what do you do on closed platforms such as a lot of the messenger services that are writing to each other that are encrypted. Like that's a tough nut to crack. And I don't know what technical capabilities there are to try to monitor that. But definitely we don't want a state, a government, or even the private sector actors monitoring our private communications. I think that's, we have to also uphold that. It's a fundamental human right. And we must also push back on over abuse of security concerns if there's no evidence of anything to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned this idea of legal action being allowed, being taken on the basis of showing intent or calling out a specific act of violence. And so considering the monitoring of situations where there isn't necessarily a domestic threat and instances of larger scale atrocity, as in the development of genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and development of these narratives. So when the existence of a malicious intent isn't so black and white in these cases stated of immediate or less immediate threats of mass atrocity, just based on opinion in terms of the level of intervention and you know how much we should be taking, how much external intervention we should be taking. What's your opinion on you know having this existence of an immediate threat versus these conversations that are obviously still detrimental but don't pose an immediate threat, like these early development of discriminatory ideals and narratives?
Yeah, well, so this is you know, there's a lot of people expressing hate online. There's a lot of extremism online, but not everybody who expresses those ideas online will actually carry out those actions, right? So there's a careful you have to be careful about expressing extremist ideas and the willingness to carry out violence. They don't always match up. It's always a smaller number of people that will do that. However, if you look at the UN Plan of Action Against Hate Speech, which deals with both online and offline expressions of hate, they give an outline of what they consider hate speech, and it's so it's using calling for violence against certain groups based on their identity, using dehumanizing language, referring to groups of people as being subhuman, as insects or rats. That's dehumanizing language, right? So these, I think, people working in police or in security services, or individuals who see something online, need to react when they see some of those examples. And I would also make the additional comment is that it also depends on who's expressing these comments online or inciting violence online. You know, the average person could be a bus driver in rural Quebec, or a, you know, a construction worker in Ontario. If someone is just saying something and it's ill-informed, that's a lot different than having a politician calling for violence or using dehumanizing language, right? So there's a difference between those who hold more power in society and have a larger broadcast platform that could radicalize others, commit action against an individual. So there's also, you know, some people are saying is that if we really have to react, it's when certain individuals that have a larger following, be it religious figures, journalists, politicians, perhaps that's when we have to put more focus on that and have an intervention earlier on based on the status of these individuals. And that the work being done on that issue is it's called work on dangerous speech, not just hate speech, but dangerous speech. So the propensity of the person who is communicating that. That there's a higher probability of their actions online resulting in offline harms, persecution, violence, and so forth.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's move to looking at some challenges in combating online extremism, some of which you've already mentioned. Part of fighting digital extremism is ensuring communication and collaboration with the owners of communication platforms to further certain goals, like elimination of echo chambers and false narratives. However, companies also have their own individual autonomy. How can policymakers balance the autonomous and privatized interests of those who own online communication platforms with their own goal of combating online extremism?
So this is a big issue, right? And because the platforms that are used today, it can be used by anybody and cross any border, or target any group from another country to towards another, is a reality. We live in the, you know, social media and cell phone technology has created a kind of a borderless world. So it's very imperative that social media companies, A, have staff, well-equipped staff, to monitor and review cases of online extremism or incitement to violence. But increasingly, because there's so many people online, is that there aren't enough people to do this. So these companies are turning to use AI algorithms for automated review of all posts, looking for incendiary language, examples that go against their principles that you agree when you sign up for a social media that you will respect certain community standards and behavior. So that's increasingly up to these companies to kind of monitor their platform, and they've been under increasing heat for not doing enough. And the other side of that is that there's increased amount of governments that are looking to legislate to try to impose measures that will hold these companies accountable to ensure that that they're doing more to counter what we call online harm. So that's hate speech, disinformation. It could be cyber harassment, a wider aspect that goes beyond just hate speech and extremism. But there's legislation that is coming through. Canada is trying to put something forward. The EU has put through laws across the entire European Union. Germany, after the inflow of many refugees from Syria and Afghanistan in 2015, 2016, we saw Germany put in a law that forced companies to take down what was deemed hate speech in a very rapid manner of time or face fines. So we're seeing this increasingly take place, but there are some dangers. It's one thing to do this in democracies and we can get things wrong, and we have the media and political opposition and academics that can weigh in and challenge government policy or challenge private sector actors. In more authoritarian states, there is a fear that that some of these laws could be put in place by authoritarian governments to go after political opposition or civil society or journalists that are reporting on human rights abuses or on actual violence against civilians. So there is a very fear that other governments could take this and use it in an irresponsible manner. And that's why the UN Plan of Action says while we must counter hate speech and online violence, we must not lose track of the importance of freedom of expression, freedom of opinion, other fundamental human rights. So one has to have a nuanced approach. If someone is complaining about corruption in country A, that government can't turn around and say, "Oh, that's hate speech against us." So there has to be some kind of focus on international standards and not just throwing out to those other fundamental human rights that I mentioned.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know hate speech can sort of look different internationally, and it has to be taken looked at individually. And so, what do you make of the problem that hate speech can also be looked at from, again, I've talked about the privatized interests of those who own communication platforms, how hate speech can be looked at differently and defined differently by different platforms. So I'll throw out the example of recent example of Elon Musk's outlook on free speech impacting Twitter. And so what do you make of this problem that what constitutes extremism and hate speech can depend on the stance of the company in terms of both in terms of allowing increased or decreased overall levels of extremist rhetoric, but also perhaps allowing extremist viewpoints against certain minorities or groups to have disproportionate levels of visibility on their platforms?
Yeah. So this is a big challenge because most of the social media companies are all based in the United States, most of the large ones, and they adhere to American law. And America, the Constitution has a very different approach, one that stands out among Western democracies on the issue of free speech. That basically says, hate speech is not there. There's different levels of tolerance in US law than there are in other democracies. So that's a reality. However, where these countries operate, sorry, where these private sector companies, these digital platforms, where they operate, such as in Canada, they have to adhere to Canadian law. So we also have robust laws on hate speech, incitement to violence, incitement to commit genocide. So we do already have measures that governments can approach social media companies and put pressure or say this is a problem, or RCMP or police force might detect something and want to investigate and get access information from social media companies. So this is the truth. But yeah, Elon Musk, he came in, wiped out the entire human rights team that worked at Twitter. I have a couple colleagues that used to work there, and so there's nobody quite there to review what automated decisions have been made. And that's contrary to there's a something called the Santa Clara principles that said that for content moderation or dealing with hate speech and other online harms, There has to be, if anything is deleted or someone's account is suspended, there has to be a human being that will eventually review this. Because sometimes we make mistakes. I've, talk about human rights abuses online. I've had multiple attempts to shut down my account, indicating I was engaging in hate speech or spreading disinformation coming from authoritarian states themselves. So one has to make sure that the private sector, that if anyone is taken offline or their accounts are suspended for suspected hate speech or it's reported by a user, that there has to be a human that's involved in the loop and review things and look into context. Automated systems don't understand humor that well. Sometimes people can be sarcastic or using satire, and they're not inciting hate speech. They're making a joke. Might be distasteful, but it's not the same as incitement to violence. So one has to be careful about how one goes about that.
And so, well, so let's return to something that you've mentioned, that in imposing or attempting to oppose these this type of legislation, there's certain platforms and more internal private messaging platforms that sort of fly under the radar. So if we talk about, where these harmful conversations take place, we have to look at and consider specific online discussion forums such as 4chan, Telegram, and Discord, to name a few, that are more difficult to monitor externally. These platforms are notorious for harboring extremist content and serve as examples of ideological echo chambers. What role do these platforms specifically play in radicalization and the spread of extremist ideologies? And how much of a problem do they really present in terms of enacting legislation and enforcing it?
Yeah, no, so this is a wider problem of these encrypted messaging apps. They're very difficult to access. Nothing's public. And some of the earlier discussions on taking down, for example, ISIS, which rose to fame in the Syrian Civil War and committed atrocities and used social media as a weapon of war to attract recruits and call for violence. Some people said we shouldn't totally knock them off of social media because then we won't be able to track them and know what they're talking about, what they might be planning. And I think with these encrypted messaging apps, it makes that much more difficult. One, it's hard to follow to know what's happening. And of course, these companies do have a responsibility that their services are not used to commit crimes. So this is like a wicked problem. I don't have a solution to counter this. There are people that are particularly studying these encrypted apps, but that has upped the game. But I would also just point out too is that unbeknownst to many people, we're also seeing some of this take place on video game platforms. ISIS used different social media platforms, Russian social media, to promote hate. And we're coming across increasing amounts of extremists on video game platforms that are spreading and looking for recruits. So it goes beyond traditional social media onto other non-social media platforms or video games writ large.
Yeah, I actually I didn't know that. That's a really new perspective. I wasn't actually aware that occurred on video game platforms, although it makes a lot of sense. So now, looking towards the future, gives us a relevant discussion on the use of artificial intelligence, right? And so I'll cite a November 2023 briefing by Tech Against Terrorism, who's worked with the Digital Mass Atrocity Prevention Lab. They're a UN-sponsored organization that has a history of working with that is a history of working with DMAP, like I said. Tech Against Terrorism identified a messaging channel in early August dedicated to sharing racist, anti-Semitic, and pro-Nazi images, which were reportedly generated using an AI art generator available mainstream on the App Store. Posts included generated images of Hitler statues, overtly anti-Semitic posts depicting Jewish individuals as goblin-looking, and an image depicting Napoleon firing into a crowd of Black Lives Matter protesters. The report also identified a pro-Al-Qaeda outlet publishing posters with realistic images, also highly likely to have been AI generated. And they also reported on the use of AI-generated imagery by actors commenting on the Israel-Hamas conflict following October 2023. And so, although these images of, for example, Napoleon shooting into a crowd of BLM protesters are obviously fake, AI-generated images of Al-Qaeda war supplies, tanks, and shoulders that are and soldiers that are meant to foster a sense of support and encourage recruitment can be much more effective in creating false narratives. So my question is, what's your take, and what's your take on the difference and this shift from unrealistic mimetic imagery to content that, to the average observer, is indistinguishable from real life images? Is this a big shift? And how effective and how dangerous can the new potential for real life image creation be compared to what we've seen in the past, which is just, racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic meme imagery?
Yeah. So first I just want to say is that you raise an important question, because when we think about online extremism, hate speech, it's either spoken videos or written words, but images, art can be used to dehumanize groups, portray them as evil and deserving violence directed towards them. So that's key. What we're dealing with here is really the rise of generative AI, which has many people working in the online space and also working on the aspect of disinformation or misinformation, really saying like this might be a game changer, because it allows people to create fake images, that can create add to narratives that might not be true, can be spread incredibly fast and play on people's emotions. And really, lie about what's going on. You mentioned where the Israel-Gaza war that's been going on since October of last year. It's a terrible war. We've seen images of human suffering on both sides. But there are people that have put out fake images or deep fake videos as well as fake images that are not true. And I ask myself, well, you don't have to create fake images. There's already some that we can get. So what's the purpose of doing this? It's either people that want to push a narrative against one side or the other, that wants to generate more polarization online and hoping that that leads to to violence and discrimination beyond the borders of the country that they live in or the city that they live in. So I think this is key. And we've also seen states use some of this technology to mount massive disinformation campaigns, but also to deny human rights abuses too. It's not just using this to incite violence or to engender a dislike towards a group. We've also seen it to deny human rights abuses. Which is also quite frightening, that we're losing track with reality. We don't know what's true anymore. So in the discussion on this, there's another discussion that generative AI or these companies must do something to allow any consumers of information online to know that it's not real. So there's talk about having these generative AI companies, ChatGPT or whether to have some kind of stamp on any image or video that they produce that would allow right away someone to say, okay, this is produced not by a person, it's fake, it's not real. So there are these wider discussions taking place. But yeah, I think this is going to be a serious additional challenge to what we've been dealing with in the last 10 to 12 years.
No, I would agree. I think that idea of stamping a watermark could be really effective, because considering this realistic content, at what point can initiatives to promote media literacy be deemed less productive or even futile? Right? Because promotion of media literacy is obviously a staple in what we've seen in the past of evaluating what we consume on the internet. But when it takes a team of experts, or a research team at Tech Against Terrorism, or even another AI software to detect these images as being fake, At what point can the average person not rely on their media literacy skills, if any? And stemming from that, is there any point in teaching it?
So this is another question. We have a problem in front of us. How do we deal with it? So there are some people that are arguing we need more legislation to hold social media companies accountable. Social media companies say we need to have better AI, and we're working on that to pick up different languages in other parts of the world where we don't have our algorithms that are trained in, be it Swahili or other languages. So that's another aspect. There's others that say that we actually need to have better media literacy skills. We need to teach young people and adults how to consume information and know whether it's coming from a reasonable source or not. And this is taking place in a backdrop of media somewhat collapsing across the world, be it print, broadcast, or radio. So that is a key thing. I think people tend to think if something's online, it has to be true. That's not the case. There's a lot of fake websites and fake information and people going to Reddit channels to think that that's the truth. And we saw the spread of disinformation during COVID, where people were obviously bored and turning to YouTube and all sorts of non-medical doctors to understand what was going on. I think this is part and parcel of the response. There has to be a whole society approach to build digital literacy skills and critical thinking, because without that, the technical response will not deal with the emotional response or the psychological response. And human beings, we're emotional, psychological animals.
In terms of that psychological and emotional response to what we see on the internet, and especially regarding who we're targeting as in who's consuming these online extremist images, is those who are consistently partaking in echo chambers and are in those private discussion forums privately, we previously mentioned. So do these attempts to teach media literacy get harder when the target population is constantly getting their worldviews bolstered by online echo chambers? And I just like your take on this idea, because obviously that is presumably the case, but are on how much harder are extremist stances to break than the average person?
Yeah, they're difficult. So first, I do think part of this story is also the issue of polarization and echo chambers. I think algorithms, after a while, will only feed you what you've clicked on or read, and will feed you a steady diet of one-sided arguments or articles. And so there's a lot of people that are saying that this is part of the problem, the way social media companies are designed is to feed you one side of the story, and that there has to be more what people say are like algorithmic accountability, looking at how these algorithms function. We've seen that during the US election. Facebook, there's reports on how Facebook helped radicalize part of the far right in the US. So this is a reality. We have to look at that as well. But I'd also say there's also increasing information that we have outside actors that are engaging online. So there's quite a few reports that have showed, for example, Russia has been very active online. Whenever there's a polarizing issue that happens, let's say in America, like the George Floyd killing, the rise of Black Lives Matter, I have spoken to AI companies that have documented an army of fake accounts, as well as some real people flooding the American social media sphere and polarizing and retweeting polarizing figures. We did some work on COVID disinformation in Canada, and we worked with an AI company to track what was taking place on Twitter. And we did come across a lot of Russian-affiliated bots and accounts retweeting and amplifying the voice of some of the more controversial, polarizing figures in Canada. So some countries are seeing this as information warfare, and they're like, if we can divide a society and turn them against each other, take away the middle area where people used to discuss and debate in a civil manner and now turn into a confrontational experience, that's taking place. And so what one also has to be careful when you're retweeting something, who are you tweeting? Who are they? What's their purpose? Are they anonymous account? Why are they anonymous? So you also have to decide, who you're going to engage with on these platforms and be a little bit more careful.
All right. Is there anything else, any closing thoughts that you'd like to give, maybe on the future, on maybe even a quick summary of what you do at the DMAP lab, just to end us off here?
Yeah. So just two things to look into the future. This is not going away. It's becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and governments are struggling to understand how can they respond to this, both through legislation, but also through operational response. So building teams that can respond, monitor in real time, to not be reactive, but to prevent some of these things happening. So we're at a crux that we need to train more students at universities to understand what's all these digital tools and how they lead to online extremism and what we can do to counter it. We don't have enough people with this expertise, so we have to catch up and build that capacity. And two, I would just say we need more collaboration between government, civil society, and the private sector. They all have different tools. Civil society in academia, outside academia, have ideas, can research this and offer suggestions. Government has resources and authority to respond. But then private sector has a lot of the technical resources as well as the funds to support some of this work. So I think we need to try to get more collaboration and not just study the issue, but actually respond to it and in a more forceful manner in a whole of society approach.
Mm-hmm. Well said. All right. Thanks for joining me today. It's been a great talk. I've learned a lot. It's been great having you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, and I'm always happy to chat.
Thanks for listening. That was Cal Matthews on MIR Meets. If you enjoyed the episode, be sure to follow the McGill International Review on Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts.